Wait just one moment, Mr. Friedman. Let's let the guests come in before you begin. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Frank Friedman, representing Karen Sloan Bratton, Administrator. Neil Johnson and Michael Gardner with me at counsel's table. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Did you say two?
Two, yes, sir. This appeal involves insurance coverage issues which arise out of a wrongful death litigation in which Bratton, the administrator of the estate of Richard Linwood Sloan, recovered a verdict of $4.35 million for Sloan's beneficiaries, his two children. Sloan, a paving company employee, was killed when a pair of drunk drivers in two separate vehicles crossed into a late-night construction site and crushed Sloan against the side of his dump truck. While the wrongful death verdict itself was sizable, the wrongdoers, Neininger and Dupre, had limited insurance. Dupre had $100,000 and Neininger had $50,000. And this shortage of insurance funds meant that UIM coverage came into play. And the question in this declaratory judgment action was, is Bratton, the administrator of Sloan's estate, entitled to recover UIM coverage from two of Sloan's employer's vehicles that were involved in the construction project? First, the dump truck Sloan himself was operating, and second, the shadow vehicle, or safety vehicle, the paving company employed to mark the construction site. This was a specialized vehicle with a raised whirling amber light that VDOT required to be at the job site. Selective's policy affords coverage to any person, quote, occupying a covered auto. That's at JA-471, and the policy goes on to define occupying at JA-470 as in, upon, using, getting in, on, out of, or off the covered auto. So for our purposes today, basically using and getting out of are the two terms that we're going to focus on in this appeal. Let's turn to the dump truck first. The circuit court found essentially that since there was no eyewitness to Sloan leaving his truck or being crushed against it, Bratton had failed to carry her burden of proving what happened and therefore failed to prove that Sloan was either using or getting out of the truck. And to reach this conclusion, we think the court had to discount a lot of circumstantial evidence as to use, and our brief discusses that in detail, and I hope to come back to that point about use.
Counsel, can I interrupt you for just 1 second? You made an argument in there that the trial court actually didn't resolve part of the occupying analysis. It reached a determination that the parties had reached an agreement. You want to talk about that for a minute? The agreement that the parties had agreed that he was not
correct.
Getting out of or getting
the
off
original,
of.
The original opinion written said that the parties agreed that getting out of wasn't at issue, and we filed a subsequent motion for reconsideration that in fact laid out half a dozen places where in fact we had, and we filed the motion for reconsideration, and the judge still opined that we hadn't proved what happened, so we didn't win, but he did say he fully considered that motion and that the objection was duly noted. So
he, I guess his ruling in essence said that you weren't getting out or off of.
We weren't.
Yeah, that he basically decided that your client did not get out of or off of the
correct. Okay. Definitely. Yes, sir.
But isn't the real issue the word using? Isn't that the focus of your case?
Well, there are two different ways to go. On the dump truck, it can be using, and I'm happy to talk about that at length because we think there's a lot of evidence of using, but we actually think that whether or not Sloan is using the dump truck, Sloan plainly was getting out of it or alighting from the truck when he was killed. He had only gotten 9 feet from the door. And selected.
Counsel, did you also prevail if he was using the chase vehicle, the safety vehicle?
Yes, sir. Basically, using either the dump truck or the safety vehicle gets us coverage. Getting out of also gets us the dump truck. So our position is he was both using the dump truck and he was getting out of it.
Counselor, do you get the same coverage? Excuse me. Do you get the same coverage if you prove that he was using both vehicles as if just one?
No, sir.
So you want to be covered under both
vehicles? We have both vehicles have a separate $1 million
right.
cap. It's the aggregate amount.
So you want to show that he's...
On either vehicle, if we could get one vehicle, we could get two vehicles.
That was one of my questions, which is you would want to get recovery under both vehicles, $2 million rather than one. But the other question I had was, is it clear from the record that the dump truck was... the engine was still engaged when Mr. Sloan was hit by the cars?
It was. The dump truck was still running at that time, and one reason for that is that if he's checking for spillage, which we think all the indications were that he was, except for one stray comment that he did that on the second, third, or fourth pour, and this happened to be the first pour, we think there was a little too much emphasis put on that because there were a lot of factors on this night. He had no spotter. They were doing a makeshift procedure that wound up causing more spillage than normal. If there's spillage back there on a cold February night, it hardens very fast. And so he's got to pull up the truck and get it taken care of.
Where is the line, Mr. Friedman, between law and fact? Because the fact finder gets the benefit of a lot of doubt when it comes to fact finding. And sometimes when we make something a matter of law, we essentially take it away from fact finders altogether. We dictate it for every other case and every other situation involving that same concept.
Well, I don't disagree with you, which is why I'm happy to argue both, but I don't think there is anything disputing that he was getting out of the vehicle. I don't think there's any way to. Now, I think that there's really every bit of evidence that he was also using it. He showed that he was checking for asphalt was the only reason he ever got out. He was headed in that direction. There was more spilled asphalt than normal that night. The safest time to check for spillage, this is at J165, was during this time when both lanes were supposed to be closed.
But we don't
so
know for
there's
sure.
There's a lot of evidence on that.
We don't know for sure whether he was doing that, do we?
Well, but what we do know for sure is that he was getting out.
But once again, Mr. Friedman, some point...
Sorry, go ahead.
But Mr. Friedman, going back to the... He said we know for sure he was getting out. He clearly was not halfway in the cab and halfway out. He was out of the car. So wouldn't whether or not he was getting out have to do with our interpretation of what getting out encompasses, which would be an interpretation of the contract, of the insurance contract, as opposed to strictly a decision based on facts?
Well, that not only is it, I think, a matter of legal interpretation of a contract, but it's also an interpretation of case law, because, and we said, there isn't a lot of getting out of case law in Virginia. What we know for a fact in this case is that he had less than 30 seconds because Harmon, once he received his asphalt, he would dump it within 30 seconds, and he hadn't dumped it yet when this accident occurred. In this time frame, before Sloan got out of the truck, he had to perform several actions, and no one disputes this. He had to get the hand signal to lower the bed of the truck, JA203. Then he lowered it, which we know, looking at the truck, there's a picture at JA420. Then he left the cab, closed the door, climbed down the stairs. This isn't a situation you open the door and you're on the street. And again, the picture at 420 shows he's got to navigate upstairs. Then he barely has time in this 25 seconds or so, including lowering the dump truck's rear. He barely had time to get anywhere. So he had gotten 9 feet from the door when he was killed. That's JA-169. And on this record, there's no time and no evidence of any kind of frolic or detour. Now, contrary, and this is a legal issue,
that we feel pretty good about, but, you know, contrary to Selective's argument, Sloan was not finished getting out of the vehicle when he slammed the door. Cases from numerous jurisdictions say that. The ALR summarizing the case law.
But is 9 feet, 10 feet, 15 feet? I mean, it just seems quite ad hoc for us to say that this trial judge was wrong in saying that 9 feet is just too far away.
Well, what the case law says, and I will address that, but in case, this is a quote, in cases where the claimant had stepped out of the vehicle and was proceeding to either end of it when injured, the courts have ruled that the claimant was alighting from the vehicle when the circumstances involved a collision between the vehicle from which he was exiting and another vehicle. Close quote. That's exactly what happened.
Right. You get out and you proceed to one end or the other of the same vehicle.
Yes.
And we know for sure he was doing that.
Well, yes. We know he never got any further than that. And the reason is, you know, some places, some...
I'm sorry, do we know that he left the vehicle and the 9 feet was towards the front or the back of the vehicle for some vehicle-related thing?
Towards the back in the direction of where he would check for spillage, yes, sir. And you can see that in the picture. You see the door and you see...
So could a fact finder conclude, I'm not convinced of that, the burden of proof is on you, and it could have happened, but preponderance doesn't establish it?
Well, he has to do more. He has to be able to do more than close the door. And that's what all the cases, including the Roberts versus Geico case, say. Alighting must extend to a situation more than when the body has reached a point of no contact with the vehicle. And the reason for that is you're still in or on it when you're shutting the door. So then you need time or distance. You know, how long is it? It's less than 30 seconds. There are very, very few cases that go that way, unless you want to rule that in means the same thing, you know, as touching, and then you've got superfluous language in the insurance contract, which we try to say never happens.
Counsel, I'm wondering whether we're losing sight of the forest for the trees, and I'm going to pick up on a term that the Chief Justice used in a prior case, which is context. And I think everyone in this courtroom, at one time or another, has driven past a nighttime construction or asphalt milling, asphalt laying project where there is continuous operations for many, many hours with very bright lights and clearly a lot of danger. Within that context, and I'll ask this of counsel for both parties, no evidence, apparently, of taking a break, using a cell phone, stretching, using the restroom facilities, nothing of that nature.
Absolutely none.
And so your argument is that this was part of the continuous operation. Is there any indication in the policy that the policy was intended to cover you for 55 minutes and then not cover you for 5 minutes, and then cover you for 55 minutes and not cover you for 5 minutes?
No. It should have covered us at all times.
And was the policy one where it's clear that the context of the risk that was being insured was asphalt laying operations?
Well, this is a business policy with a paving company. And yes, we think it's pretty obvious, in fact, in what the parties are bargaining for, that it would encompass paving work. I might add that this is the exact danger that the safety vehicle is there to stop or to protect against, is night drivers inattentively coming in. And that's the exact thing that killed Mr. Sloan. So we think that that also militates towards use of the specialty, it's called the shadow vehicle.
Okay, I don't want to take the rest of your rebuttal time, so I'll wait.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the Court, Kailani Memer on behalf of Selective Insurance Company of America.
Before you get into your argument,
yeah,
I'd
sure.
like to ask the exact, you just heard that series of questions, so I'm not going to waste time going back through them, but can we not consider context? Is it improper for us to not to consider context in determining use and getting out of in this instance?
I think it's certainly important for the court to consider the context of the facts of each particular case. each particular case. That's what this court has done since it started these decisions with Perry and through Simpson in 2010, the particular facts of each particular case.
Okay. And so if we have to, if we presume that individuals do have to get out of the vehicle occasionally during over the course of an 8-hour shift, should we conclude that you are, again, insured for 55 minutes and then not insured for 5 minutes, and then insured for 55 minutes and not insured for 55 minutes based upon getting out to check spillage, getting out to stretch your legs, getting out, you know, for any number of other purposes?
No, I can't see any possible argument that that would be contemplated by insurers in Virginia, that there is a continuing umbrella of coverage for every activity that happens on every work site. So
not every activity, it's the activity of using a dump truck to pour asphalt over a multi-hour period.
But in terms of what I hear Your Honor saying is that getting out to stretch or do other things, that you would still be engaged in that ultimate task of getting asphalt to a scene.
No. But in this instance, there is no evidence of using rest facilities, stretching, anything of that nature. In this instance, the evidence appears to be that he was still on task, so to speak. Is that correct?
I don't think it is in this case.
Okay. Where is the evidence that he was not on task?
Well, first of all, I think we have to start with the evidence of, was he on task? We don't know what he was doing. That's what makes this case completely unique from any other case involving use that this court has ever decided. No one saw him get out of the vehicle. No one had any communication with him getting out of the vehicle. There was no walkie-talkie. There was no witness who saw him get out. We don't know if he went to the front of the truck. We don't know if he went around the truck. We don't know if he used his cell phone and put it back in. We just don't know.
Which party has the burden of proof?
The party seeking coverage.
So if the fact finder doesn't find a 51% probability that these criteria are met, these contextual criteria are met.
Absolutely.
Is this a workers' comp policy?
Yes.
And it's related to the vehicle?
Yes. Yes. What they're seeking coverage under here is obviously business auto. But you're exactly correct that in this case, the trial court sat as the finder of fact. And when he did so, he heard the evidence, he saw the evidence, he determined the credibility of the witnesses, and he found that there wasn't sufficient evidence. He was not willing to speculate as to what Mr. Sloan was doing when he got out of the truck.
Well, counsel, may I ask you a question about that, the getting out of the truck? What does getting out of mean? Does it mean one leg in and one out?
I think if we look at this court's decision in Newman, where we've got a child, I think it matters in the circumstances of each and every case. In Newman, this court talked about getting in, obviously, and whether a child was in the process of getting on a school bus at the time. I think that the problem, again, is that we don't have the particular circumstances of this case.
Well, counsel, isn't more an equal problem that this court has never had to really directly interpret the phrase getting out of and what the parameters may be in determining whether or not a certain set of facts come within the legal interpretation of getting out of?
Yes, absolutely.
And so we have not said getting out of is one leg in, one leg out, getting out of, and some courts have said it depends on the distance and the time and the location. We haven't set up that interpretive structure yet, have we?
We have not. And I think if we look at Roberts versus Geico, the Western District case of Judge Williams, for any kind of instruction, in that case, again, we knew what the intent was. We knew that the individual who was driving had to get to the back of the car and open the door and assist. We knew what the intent was. We had observation of what people were doing, where they were, and what proximity, the path that they took. Unfortunately, in this case, that is that critical void of evidence. All we know is that he got out of the truck and he closed the door. He closed the door. We don't know if he went out into the road, if he was waving the cars. We don't know if he tried to go around to the front. He was struck 9 feet from the door. But we don't know if he walked directly 9 feet or if he walked out to the side. We don't know if he went up to the tractor to try to say, oh my gosh, something's going on. We don't have
the fact that he was out of the duck truck. Does that mean he was no longer using the safety vehicle, which was mandated to be there and which, in fact, was there the entire time he was on the job site?
I don't think that's a safety vehicle. If it was a safety vehicle under the work area protection manual, it was mandated. It shall be placed within 50 to 100 feet of the work zone.
What was it?
It was 200 feet back.
But what was it if it wasn't a safety vehicle?
It was a vehicle that was brought. It was a means of transportation for, as Mr. Harmon admitted, it was a truck that was used to bring tools, people, and water to the job site. It was like any other truck. If that truck, because it has a yellow light on it, is a vehicle that somehow would bring every construction worker under the umbrella of coverage, then all of the workers, not just the SR Draper workers, but the Raysink workers that were in front of them, the other guy that was taking soil samples on the other side of the truck,
all... Did the judge make a finding of fact that it wasn't a safety vehicle?
The court made a finding of fact that it was not a shadow vehicle under the Work Area Protection Manual because the WAPM mandated that that truck be placed within 50 to 100 feet. It wasn't a guideline.
Is there a safety vehicle other than a shadow vehicle?
Not within not within either the Work Area Protection Manual or within the meaning of coverage. And I think when this court, looked at that within the scope of the Parker case, the Parker plaintiff argued that I was positioning my vehicle in such a way to provide protection to me and I had the door open to use a radio. But what this court said was that your supervisor never mandated that you use that as a safety vehicle. In this case, Mr. Harmon was never told to use that as a safety vehicle. S.R. Draper and the general contractor, Raysink, had contracted out with LMC Barricade, a professional organization, to set up traffic control devices and to provide anything that needed to be complied with under the Work Area Protection Manual. Harmon was never directed by his employer. In fact, Randy Draper testified at the trial and said there was no need whatsoever for his vehicle to be there, or a safety vehicle, or a vehicle with any light on it. Harmon was never told to put that there. He never told Raysink that he put it there. And I think even more importantly for this court to consider is what did Richard Sloan know? It's the estate that is seeking coverage, arguing that he is using a vehicle, and there is no evidence that he knew that that vehicle was even on site. There was never any discussion between Mr. Sloan and Mr. Harmon about having a vehicle there, where to place it, what lights to use. So now in Slagle, where this court has said, okay, you don't have to either have occupied or have an intent to occupy a vehicle to have coverage, but now the argument is not only do you not have to occupy or intend to occupy, but you don't even have to know the vehicle is there. You don't have to know it's there.
As long as you're within a football field away from it.
Exactly. Or two football fields. Now imagine a work zone where we've got a 5-mile stretch on I-95. And we have all the construction set up before that. 5-mile road milling. That shadow vehicle or any vehicle with a yellow strobe light back down the highway all of a sudden creates an umbrella of coverage for every single person, whether they know that truck is there or not.
There be 75 guys using the same vehicle?
That's a lot of insurance. And that's not what was contemplated under this policy or any other policy with regard to use. So now this court, in order to find use for the shadow vehicle, would have to find that not only do you have to, you've never been in it, you never used any equipment off of it, you had no intention to occupy it, and in fact you didn't even know it was there, but you are using it under 38.2-2206.
But, counsel, wouldn't we also have to substitute our own judgment for the factual findings of the court here? And in the order, in the opinion letter, the court actually says on several times there are conflicts and gaps in the evidence, conflicting testimony. He said Mr. Harmon was essentially not credible because he made statements inconsistent with sworn statements he had made in the past. I mean, this was a difficult factual record with lots of conflicts and gaps and inconsistent statements.
Absolutely. This court, when we, obviously with the judgment of the trial court, have heard the evidence, had the ability to ascertain the credibility of the witnesses, is entitled to the same weight this court has set as a jury verdict. It is sacrosanct. And the credibility of the witnesses was something, obviously, that the trial judge determined. The only evidence as to either the checking for spillage came from Mr. Harmon. And Mr. Harmon was the very witness that the trial judge said, this person has given statements inconsistent with statements in terms of the criminal trial and in his deposition, and yet Harmon was the only one to say that he had checked for spillage. The other individuals who were on site never say any such thing. Mr. Lambert, who was there all night long, never saw Mr. Sloan get out of the truck. Sloan's job was to drive the dump truck that evening. Hawks, who was the guy who at the last second who runs out to flag, said that he had seen Sloan pulling the truck up, but he never said that he saw him get out of the truck checking for spillage. Hopkins, the other man on site, never provided any such testimony. And Hefner, who was not an SR Draper guy but was on the side of the truck checking soil samples, said that he saw the trucks moving up on occasion and that the workers would scrape up the spillage, but he never said that he saw Sloan or any other dump truck operator outside of the truck. So the only argument for use of the truck and checking from spillage comes from Harmon, who the trial court had the opportunity to see and to hear and to see him be cross-examined, and he said it doesn't make any sense. The only way that checking for spillage would make any sense anyway is if it happened on the second, third, or fourth pour, as Harmon said. Well, the trial court said, I find his evidence to be equivocal. First of all, he said, I don't even know. And then he said, second, third, or fourth pour. So it was not credible. Hawks, on the other hand, was completely credible to the trial court. And this court cannot now Monday morning quarterback the credibility of these witnesses that the trial court had determined. Hawks said it was the very first pour. We had been waiting. We had been on a break. Harmon had been waiting. And that makes perfect sense with the totality of the circumstances, because if they're on a break and all of a sudden Sloan pulls in and this is the first pour, that's the only way it makes sense for Hawks to go, uh-oh, we don't have a spotter. We don't have a flag person. So Hawk says, oh my gosh, I got to grab that stop paddle and run down the highway 200 to 300 feet away trying to stop traffic. Now, if it's the second, third, or fourth pour, he's already in position. He's not running down the road to try to stop traffic. And so it makes sense, and it made sense to the trial judge who heard that evidence.
Well, Ms. Kimmerer, is this the same analogy or the same analysis applicable to the getting out of the truck? I mean, if the jury were improperly instructed, if this were a jury case, and the jury were improperly instructed on what elements it was to consider on whether or not Mr. Sloan was getting out of the truck, this court would not be bound by the jury's determination under improper instructions, would it?
It would not under improper instructions.
So if the court, if the trial court was using a construct of getting out of that was incorrect, I'm not saying that it was or wasn't, we wouldn't have the same issue as you've just explained with regard to the facts regarding using the vehicle. Is that correct?
I think that we do, based upon the way this case is set up, because what the court ultimately ruled was that the state had not met its burden of proof. It was incumbent upon the estate to come forward with facts, not assumptions, not hypotheticals, but facts, that he was still in the process of getting out of the truck. And yet there are no facts as to the path that he took, the distance that he took, his intent, where he was. And the only thing we do know, the only fact we know right before the impact itself, is that he was hollering to Harmon. He was the only person on that job site that was in the near vicinity of the back of the truck. Somebody hollered to Harmon, and then he looks, sees a car, tries to go forward. Someone is hollering and warning to him. It's not Hopkins, it's not Lambert, it's not Hefner. They didn't see it. There was nobody else there.
But there was some, I think you said he was near the truck.
Yes.
The engine was still on. He hadn't terminated his connection, so to speak, with the truck. So we do know that.
I think he
had. But we don't know what the trial court considered as getting off.
I think he had terminated it simply because the only fact that we do know is he's hollering. So his hollering is not vehicle-oriented. Just at the critical time of the accident, he's hollering. That is not a vehicle-oriented act, number one. Number two, the door is closed. So he would have to come forward with evidence saying, yes, even though I closed the door, my intent was to do something different.
Okay.
And
now,
we don't have that evidence.
One element you haven't spoken to is the use of the dump truck. We talked about getting out of the dump truck. We talked about the use of the safety vehicle or whatever that vehicle was that was back there. The fact that the engine was still on, how does that relate to whether he was using or not using the vehicle? Is that relevant to whether he was using or not using the vehicle?
I don't think it is. I think we have to look at the totality of the circumstances and facts. In the Parker case, as I recall, the engine was running, the door was open, the radio was on so that she could continue to communicate with her supervisor. So I think you have to look at all of the circumstances, and again, that is the critical problem in this case, is we just don't know those circumstances. That is the void that the estate was faced with in this case in terms of something more, not just that the truck was running, but what was his intent, where had he gone, what had he done. And if he'd had some equipment in his hand, maybe a shovel or something else, similar to the clipboard in Cassell, maybe we would have more evidence upon which to make such an assumption. But there was no one saw him, and he had no equipment in his hands. And so that's, again, this void, this unwillingness of the trial court to speculate and put together those facts.
May I ask a question? If we adopt your theory in terms of proof, if you had a single car accident when another car drove in there, there were no other people around, and a driver was outside his car, the car was running, the door was closed, the driver was, when the police found him, was 9 feet from the door. Under your theory, you could never recover under a UIM policy. Is that correct?
I don't think you could, based upon the precedent of this court, which says that we must look at the specific facts of each and every case. If we don't have those facts, no, other than the proximity, I don't think it would be proper for the court to fill in speculation as to the intent and the purpose, and then you'd have to speculate again to the mission. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Kemmer. Member, your time has expired. Rebuttal.
Thank you. Justice Lacey, I assured you that the dump truck was running, but I forgot to give you the site. It was JA 157-158. It clearly was still running. What Selective seems to argue is that circumstantial evidence, we can't trust it. And, in the Randall case, there was no witness. But we looked at the circumstantial evidence, and we knew there was a co-worker, but he didn't see the actual accident.
But we don't look at the circumstantial. We're not trial judges. We don't sit around and determine whether circumstantial evidence meets the burden of proof. We only ask one question, whether a rational fact finder could look at the circumstantial evidence and weigh it the way they weighed it, which is a very different question.
Well, sometimes you can look at a clear error of an opinion, and here, and I think Selective said, the reason this wasn't a safety vehicle is because it was 200 feet away from the dump truck. And that's just wrong. What is required is that it be from 50 to 100 feet from the beginning of the work area. And this was 200 feet from the truck, the dump truck, but the dump truck was towards the back. It's uncontradicted that there were flaggers and roller men in front of that. So it was 200 feet from the dump truck. So the factual finding, this is 200 feet, it's too far away, it's not a shadow vehicle, is wrong. And here's evidence, 219, 176, and 390, that there were flaggermen up front. If the truck is being used as a shadow vehicle, it's being used as one, whether it's imperfectly being used or not, in any event, its use.
Does it matter whether or not the company intended it to be used for that purpose?
I think that it matters to the extent that we do look at the intention of the parties. There's the whole nexus idea. The idea that everybody and their brother is covered on this work site if there's a shadow vehicle just isn't right. This court has found nexuses. Now, this is critically important in response to your question. I don't want to go too long, but if you look at JA 485, which is the WAPM, which is what everybody is saying, the experts said this is a shadow vehicle, and it's the Bible, there is a shadow vehicle drawn on there. Selective's position is we didn't have to do that. Selective signed on with LMC to do signage and cones. The only people who brought flaggers or his shadow vehicle was Mr. Harmon and...
I've got a follow-up, Chief. It's my understanding, though, that representative for Draper said that I was never told to turn on the caution light. I was never told to use this as a shadow vehicle. I just happened to have it there. That's what I was talking about as far as the intention of the use of the vehicle.
Well, Mr. Harmon said, I did put it on for safety. That's JA-172. He called it a safety strobe, I think. He said that's what he always did at JA-176. And here's the fun, you know, everybody, a man was killed. And so a lot of people are trying to distance themselves from what happened. But let me say this. At JA-134, Selective admits, there's a request for admission, that Harmon is the supervisor of this project. And he is the one, the fellow that they're mentioning doesn't even know what the WAPM is. You know, the man there taking care of the safety, this is the second night.
I think you've answered the question. Your time has expired. The court will take a brief recess.
All right.